Well, welcome back, students, to the Western Theological Tradition. By this time, you've finished the book of Genesis. And normally in class, I would ask you, as I mentioned last time, what's your favorite character or who stands out to you and why? And there's a number of people in this second half of the book. This family has grown big with the 12 sons, and there's several mothers even involved, as well as many of these brothers. And so some people, some of the students have come back and told me, you know, Esau or Jacob stands out, or, you know, I think of maybe Joseph. Joseph might be the most maybe shining light in the book, it would appear, though there's some aspects of his character that I also question, and maybe you do too. And so as we consider our four major questions that we're taking into our reading of Scripture, book by book, looking at the big picture of things, who is God, who is man, what's the problem, and what's the solution? By now, I hope you can recognize that God is very subtle, patient, as well as personable and promising. God gives many promises, even promises sealed with a covenant, an oath, and a sacrifice in blood. We're going to talk about covenants in a few lessons from now and the significance of them, but there are several covenants in this book that God has promised to do things for these patriarchs or for even the world. And so that sets the stage of anticipation for the rest of the Bible. Genesis is a book of many beginnings, this being a big aspect of it. We also see how God is not quick to react. He lets sin go on for a long time, or he lets his promises remain unfulfilled for a long time. And as with Job, we often, as people, want to interpret God's ways based on an assumption as if he would act immediately. And by now, I hope you recognize that the Bible's presentation of God is not that kind of immediate action. God is a God who weaves together a variety of events, and the New Testament, quoting the Old Testament, emphasizes that God is not slow about his promises. A day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years, Psalm 90 says, is as a day. And so, 2,000 years since Christ, 4,000 years since Abraham, is less than a week in its feel with God. Given that kind of eternal perspective, he doesn't think he's behind times. He doesn't think he's slow. And so we are left then with the choice of faith. Are we going to take him at his word, believe him, which would lead to a hopeful anticipation, waiting for him to act? Or are we going to walk by sight based on our empirical evidence or what we've experienced and judge him on that basis? This becomes then a fundamental divide among humans. And as we saw last time, there is the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. There's the seed of Abraham, and that seed, being in like kind, is characterized by what characterized Abraham, which is what? Yes, faith. So by the end of the book, then, we are looking for people who exhibit faith. But if we move to that question, what is man like? We are left perhaps perplexed by the end of the book. I mean, Abraham's a decent fellow, lies a couple times. His son ends up imitating him and lies as well. Both of these men passing their wife off as a sister in order to spare their own skin. This is evil for at least two reasons. Three, probably, evil and lying. Evil then to the people he lied to, because they would have committed adultery. Evil to his wife, putting her in that predicament. And then evil before God and not waiting for him and trusting him. And so Abraham being a man of faith doesn't mean he's a man of perfect faith. It's a general characteristic of his life. It's not a moment by moment experience or reality. Well, he's at least commendable, but when we get to Jacob, and we're going to talk about him and his brother, and then Jacob's family, I mean, this is dysfunctional. I mean, the whole thing is a mess. I mean, Simeon and Levi, Reuben's the oldest, he sleeps with his dad's concubine, so he doesn't get the blessing, and then Simeon and Levi are the next two in line, and they avenge their sister's rape by setting up, as if they're going to give her in marriage to Shechem, this Canaanite man, and then so they set it up by having all the men of the city circumcised, and then when they're in deep pain, they go in and slaughter them all. I mean, at first Jacob is like, you have just made me odious in the eyes of the Canaanites. You've risked our survival here. Even later, Jacob goes deeper in his rebuke of Levi and Simeon, speaking in his blessing in chapter 49 that the swords, their swords are implements of violence. Let not my soul enter into their counsel. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. I want nothing to do with them, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, their wrath, for it is cruel. And he's going to disperse them when they settle into the promised land. And so, I mean, these are rough characters. Let's just put it that way. And then the rivalry between Rachel and Leah, and God is blessing Leah because she's the unloved wife, and then Rachel, you know, is the woman that is envious and almost like blaming Jacob why she doesn't have children. And of course, he's not God, I can't give you children. And so then finally she is blessed, and then they're rivaling back and forth with give the maid to Jacob, give my maid to Jacob. And so now Jacob's got like four women, four wives. This is not the way God designed it in the beginning. One man, one woman for life is the pattern Jesus affirms about marriage for all time and all cultures. Whew! No wonder the law of Moses later, you know, forbids a man to marry two sisters. I mean, what a recipe for an unrestful household. And so the whole family, that's a lot of people. There's quite a bit of mess there, and we'll get into some of the characters in a little bit. And so what's the problem? Well, the problem is if this continues among the nations, not only, you know, in the, say, the chosen people, but, you know, we got Egyptians dealing in slavery, we're going to find out in the next book. We got, you know, we got the Sodom and Gomorrah crowd over there, the Canaanites, who God's going to spare them from another 400 years, but they're just descending into deep immorality and inhospitality, which means not caring for the stranger, but actually doing violence to the stranger. And so the two are combined, as we would say in our culture, sex and violence. And so we see that the world, if left to itself, will go back to those pre-flood days. And so what about the promise? In you, I will bless all the families of the earth. Where's that promise, God? By the end of the book, though God had covenanted to give Abraham land and seed, Abram, all he ended up with is a cemetery, and the people who are his family, 70 in numbers, don't even end up in the land. They're down in Egypt. No nation appears to be even touched by the blessing of God yet, or hardly. And so here we are at the end of the book. At least it explains to the original audience, why did our forefathers come out of Egypt as slaves? Oh, so that's how they ended up in Egypt. Okay, so yeah, God gave us that land, but for a season, they sojourned in the land of Egypt, and then we became slaves there. But still, this is merely, I don't know merely, but it is a book of beginnings, is it not? We are just starting the big story. God is putting into place elements that will be incorporated into that big story. And as we consider two brothers, two pairs of brothers today in our lesson, I want us to see how this book portrays God and how he uses man and works in and through man to accomplish his purposes. What we call God's ways or patterns, types, are being laid out already in the book of Genesis, by which we can then interpret later history in the Bible and even begin to interpret with some measure of certainty our own lives as we compare, and our own times as we compare them to the patterns given to us in the Bible. So, briefly then, just consider the family of the chosen seed. When you go, you know, leading up to the family, we have, you know, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, and their son Seth, through whom Noah comes. Noah has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And it's through Shem that we end up down to Abraham. Abraham, of course, marries Sarah. They have Ishmael by her maid, Hagar. They have Isaac, the promised seed. Then Isaac marries Rebekah. They have twins, and that's it, Esau and Jacob. And he's like the only, one of the only guys that, maybe the only guy that has one wife. And then Jacob, whose name is later changed to Israel, has 12 sons and daughters. We know that there's more than one daughter. Dana is named. And so he has an extremely large family through the four women that he has. By the end of this long chart, we are convinced that God's choices are counterintuitive. Now, on the one hand, that can be quite hopeful. For those of us with an inferiority complex, or basically with a track record of failure behind us, the fact that God could choose failures is a hopeful thought. Now, it's also, to those of us who think highly of ourselves and think well of our character, this should put us in a situation, almost put us in our place a little bit, that God is not a God who needs us. Job 41, a verse that Scheinlin didn't translate for some reason, speaks about that all the heavens are mine. What can you give to me that I must give back to you? One of the lessons from the book of Job is that God is a God who has no needs, and so you can never put him in your debt and force his hand. And so if he does things, if he would reward certain aspects of character, he is doing it because he wants to and appreciates this or that aspect, but not because he is obligated, obliged, or in debt. When you're dealing with the human race, chapter 3 says we should have perished in the garden. The day you eat of that tree, you will surely die. And though Athanasius will camp out on that verse later in a book we read on the Incarnation, at the very least we could say that the fact that Adam and Eve left the garden, though they're prohibited from God's presence from re-entering the garden, they survived, and the human race survived with them. All of us are born outside of Adam, or outside of Eden. And as a result of that, we would be hard-pressed then to say, God, give strict justice to everything that you do. If that had happened, we wouldn't even be here. Now, these are some of the large questions and pictures that we get from the book of Genesis. Again, God's choices are counterintuitive. At the very least, we see it in him choosing bad persons. We also see it in him choosing the youngest, which seems to be a pattern. So he chooses Isaac, not Ishmael. He chooses Jacob, not Esau. Even though they're twins, there's still an oldest and a youngest, even if it's just a matter of minutes. And we'll see later, David is the youngest of eight, and others are like that, where God passes by the oldest and chooses the youngest. Perhaps one of the most humorous ways he did it is at the end of the book where you know, Joseph brings his two sons to his father, his very elderly father, Jacob, who is leaning on his staff, and Joseph then puts them in the right order. He has Manasseh, the oldest, before Jacob's right hand, which would be the Yamin hand, the hand of strength, and then he puts Ephraim, the second born, at his left. But Jacob switches his hands and puts the right hand on Ephraim's head. And Joseph goes to grab it, and of course his father, you know, stops him and says, you know, basically, I know what I'm doing, and blesses the youngest, who becomes first rank, actually, among the tribes as they enter the new land. Well, let's go into the two brothers that we're going to consider today. We're first of all going to look at Esau and Jacob, and then we're going to look at Judah and Joseph. So Esau and Jacob, as I said earlier, are twins. It was interesting, their mother, Rebecca, was quite confused about them because her womb seemed to be unusually active. And so she inquired of the Lord, and he said that there are two nations in your womb. Now, that would be a really active pregnancy. But obviously these boys will become two nations. Two peoples will be separated from your body. One people will be stronger than the other. And very significantly, the older shall serve the younger. The Bible says that the Lord said this to her. We do not know that Isaac had any inkling about this. And that's important in a couple episodes. So, what do we learn about the boys? Well, one comes out, the firstborn comes out, and he's hairy, like a garment, like a fur coat, you might say. And so he's called rough. Speaking of his texture, Esau apparently speaks of that roughness. He's a rough fellow. And that really fits his character well. He's a pretty rough guy, a man in the open field. He loves to hunt. He's kind of a man's man. And then Jacob comes out grabbing his brother's heel, which is the significant idiom. To be a heel grabber is to be a deceiver or a trickster in Hebrew. We even have a phrase like that in English, don't we? Where you're pulling my leg, we would say. Now, for us, it's a little less harmless. I think it's really sinister in this language, in that culture. And so here's the two boys. Hello, Mr. Ruff. Hello, Mr. Trickster. These are quite the names. So I have a rough man and I have a tricky man, a deceitful man, as my two boys. Ain't I proud, right? So, first episode. Just to give us a flavor, this is the way that Hebrew narrative works so well. Before the big scene shows up, we get this little snippet scene that gives us a taste of their character. And so here comes, you know, Esau coming out from the field and dressed in his camo and, you know, has his rifle over his back and he's tired and famished. Probably didn't bring food or ate it all up and gone way out. And so he sees his brother Jacob cooking a meal. It's like, give me some of that. And Jacob, of course, senses a deal. Says, oh, you're famished, are you? Sell me your birthright. Now, the right of primogeniture, of being the firstborn, is a big deal in this culture. And so Jacob senses an opportunity. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. So what's the use then of a birthright to me? If I'm going to die, it wouldn't matter anyway. So then Jacob, he wants to make sure, says, first swear to me. Give me an oath. And so Esau says, basically, it's as the Lord lives, I swear you have my birthright. Okay. And then Jacob gives Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank, and that apparently the lentil stew was a red color, it was like red stuff, and so Esau's nickname was Red as a result, or Edom, and that's the nation that he becomes, which is south of the Dead Sea, is where they settled. A very arid region, and it had even some red soil, I understand. Now, what do we think about this? Those of you with an economics major, I'm sure you know, would recognize that an economic transaction is fair and square if both sides agree, and they both come out in a win-win situation. If it's done with their consent, who can complain, right? And yet, doesn't it leave a bad taste in your mouth? It'd be similar to me going to a garage sale, and if I knew that this, you know, say, hunting knife or, you know, this kind of coffee pot or something was, you know, silver, let's say a silver set of, you know, finery. If I knew that this is worth $1,000 or $2 and they're selling it for, you know, $50, do I tell them? In love, do I tell them that you really need to raise the price of this? You don't even know what you have on your hands. Or do I sniff a deal? Like, oh boy, do I got a bargain. Now some of you will say, but it's fair and square. They put the price on it, and so take it. Walk away with it. It would be legal, but would it be ethical? And that's Jacob. If Esau is a rough man, he's kind of like your, you know, live for the weekend, here's my six pack, I'm going to enjoy, have a good time with my buddies, and what you see is what you get with Esau. In some respects, I like that. I don't like his values, but the fact that he is what he is, there's something commendable about that, just straightforward. But with Jacob, Jacob's a smooth man. He's a smooth dealer, and he's a wheeler and dealer. When do you know that you're getting it straight from such a man? And this is the way that we as people are. The Bible says that some people's sins go ahead of them, while other people's sins follow behind. They're not as evident or as known. I think I can actually resonate a lot with Jacob. I remember cheating my brother when I was growing up. I would like, say, back in the day where there's, you know, albums and cassettes, and say, I like that band and I'd really love to have that, you know, that album, and I'd urge my brother to buy it, and then I'd dub it, which is pirating, stealing it. It was a double wrong because he's spending his money, I didn't want to spend my money, and then I steal it from him. Can I borrow it from you? I was that kind of a trickster when I was younger. You know, I'd go back home and bring people from college and, hey, I had a car and yeah, you can ride with me, and I'd fill it up before we left town, said $5 from everybody back in the day where $5 meant something. And I remember my buddy from high school called me out and said, look, the amount of gas that you're putting in this car is not, I mean, adding up all the $5 around here. You're not even getting to that point. And of course, I saw it as an opportunity to make a little money. It's that kind of smooth dealer. That's what Jacob is. And I think it's good for us to look at our society not through the eyes of, say, media or our personal experience by sight, but to look at it the way that God looks at it. God looks at the heart. And the Bible's way of kind of getting underneath the heart of things is so important. When I was in Minneapolis, I was in the second worst neighborhood, and they were selling drugs across the street. And I remember those that, you know, would be there, and the house was run down. I remember one of them coming across asking food, you know, and it's like, it was just, the families were degraded and just oppressed and poor and enslaved, really, in their addictions. And I was told by the neighbor, kind of kitty corner to us, that the person running the drug ring would show up at 1 a.m. for 1 minute, was a white man from the suburbs, and apparently worked for the bank that had this property under foreclosure or something to that effect. And that story struck me as such an illustration of the fact that misuser of humans who are using that substance, both are misusing things God had made. Both were in the wrong, but one was visible, one was not. Well, this shows up, does it not, when the two brothers then are going to, basically the time of the blessing comes, and Isaac is an old man and his eyesight is weak, and he sends out his oldest son to get some of his game that he loves to eat, some of that good venison, and cook it up his special way, and I'll bless you, my son, when I'm in that good mood. And the mother hears of it and says to Jacob, as Jacob's a mama's boy, and says, here, my son, do this. Dress up like your son, like your brother Esau, and take this goat, prepare it the way your father likes it. And Jacob's like, if he knows that it's me, I'll not get a blessing, I'll end up getting a curse. And she says, oh, let it come upon me, my son. And you remember that curse and blessing is a big deal. And so here comes the youngest son then, with goatskin on his hands and goatskin on the back of his neck, reminding us how hairy Esau really is, wearing Esau's clothes. And of course, Jacob is confused. It's the voice of Esau. I mean, it's the voice of Jacob, but it feels like Esau. And so with the five senses, one of them compromised already, and the taste is going to be neutralized because the dish is prepared similarly. You're left with the three, right? And so hearing, it's Jacob. Feeling, it's Esau. And when he comes close to kiss his father, Jacob, wearing his brother's clothes, Isaac then at that moment is convinced the weight of judgment has tipped to the deciding sense of smell. And he goes, this is the smell of the outdoors. This is my son, Esau, and he blesses him in a blessing that's mutually exclusive. You can't just say, oh, may you prosper, kind of general. No, it's that may you rule over your brothers and may nations serve you. This is part of the kingdom wrapped up in the promise. And just as Jacob leaves, in comes Esau, telling his father to eat, bless me. And Isaac trembles. Well, if you're Esau, who was that? And Esau begins to be aware then of what's gone on, and he's not getting the blessing. He says, bless me, bless me. And then Isaac says, your brother has stolen the blessing. And Esau says, is he not rightly called a heel grabber? Is he not rightly a trickster? Two times he has taken away from me. Now, I think that's poor memory on Esau's part. Esau swore the birthright away. It was his choice. But now he's blaming it wholly on Jacob. And I'm not saying Jacob's cleared either, because Jacob's an opportunist. He deals in that kind of realm. And so Esau, though, slants it like it's all Jacob's fault. And of course, in this case, it's purely Jacob's fault, deceiving his own father and stealing the blessing from his brother. And then Esau, in great tears, then says, bless me, and Isaac can't, and basically assigns him to the outcast realm. Now, with this in mind, it's important to realize that, well, many educators talk about what's called the moral imagination and the importance of stories. It's a curiosity to me that educators often point to fairy tales being so important. The Bible has also the emphasis on the moral imagination, but it doesn't point to fairy tales. It points to history, a God-written or scripted history. There's meaning in these individuals, and these individuals, though real in a fact-value union, also symbolize values. And so if Jacob symbolizes being a trickster, Esau also symbolizes something bad. In the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, tells Christians that there should be no immoral or godless person among you like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. Now think about that. This is like that old, fable about the goose that laid the golden egg. In a rash of impulse to kill the goose because I just need a meal right now and I want it to be good is foolish. It's short-sighted and takes no thought to the future. And it's that aspect of no thought to the future, godless. He's not valuing the promises that are given in that birthright. Those promises pertain to all the families of the earth. And this son disregarded those big promises for one meal. That short-sightedness, though we might respect him for being an open man, we cannot respect his values because they're so impulsive and short-sighted. And it then concludes in the book of Hebrews, for you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, For he found no place for repentance, though he sought for it with tears. Though it's tempting to see that no place for repentance, meaning Esau could not repent or change his heart or mind, I think in the context of the story, it's better to see it Isaac is not changing his mind, even though Esau is seeking it with tears. The door has shut. And of course, Esau is going to avenge himself. And so Rebecca says to her son, Jacob, you need to run for your life. And I'm sending you back to my family in Mesopotamia, where Abraham originally was and where the rest of the distant relatives are. And so he runs for his life. And then Esau is left stewing back in Canaan. Now, before we close out this episode, let's just look at the next scene, the last scene. What happens to Jacob? Well, as Jacob's fleeing the land, he stops at a place called Bethel, and he has a dream. It's very famous. It's Jacob's ladder. There's actually something in electricity that deals with two filaments rising, you know, where a spark goes up it. It's called, I think, Jacob's ladder as well. But so God is up at the top of the ladder and angels are going to and fro on this ladder. And in this dream, God says to Jacob, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your seed. So this tells us that the blessing is sticking. Jacob is actually being blessed right now by God in this vision while he sleeps. Your seed shall be like the dust of the earth, spreading out to the west and east, north and south. In you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So he's repeating Abraham's blessing. Behold, he says, I will be with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done for you what I have promised you. I'm going to be with you, Jacob. I'm going to bring you back to this land. Wow. Those are big promises. Now, Jacob's response, waking up from his sleep, says, surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. In all honesty, students, I think you could tattoo that across his forehead. That like symbolizes Jacob's life. Surely the Lord is with this life and I don't realize it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? We would say, how terrifying or fearsome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. The house of God, literally in Hebrew, is Beth El. And so Bethel, he names the place Bethel, erects a stone, pours some oil on it, and makes a memorial there. And God ends up later bringing him back to this place and reaffirming the blessing. Now, this leads us then to that question about God again. What are we dealing with here? God's just freely blessing this man who just cheated his father? Is God just going to let him get off the hook? Well, no. I want you to remember this phrase. There's poetic justice in the book of Genesis. I use the word poetic justice to describe its fitting. It's not an earned, in debt thing as much as a fitting thing, where Jacob deceives his father, right? Pretending to be a brother. What happens to him in this story that would resemble that? Right? When he comes into Mesopotamia, he meets Laban, and he finds out, you know, Laban has a pretty daughter, and he works 7 years for this daughter, Rachel, and of course, on the wedding night, Laban switches the girls. And so Jacob then marries his sister, the sister, Leah, with the weak eyes. Something's wrong with her appearance, or maybe her vision, or both. And then, of course, a week later, he's also given Rachel, but he has to work another 7 years. And so the poetic justice, even though the Bible doesn't even pinpoint it, it's so apparent. Deceiving a father, deceived by a father, pretending to be a brother, a sister, pretending to be a sister. When I've asked students about this poetic justice, they've also told me, and I think it's rightly so. Later, he gets deceived by his own sons when they pretend that Joseph is dead. And so, God, yes, God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. The New Testament affirms that. Jacob does receive it, and as he tells Pharaoh, my days have been few and evil, meaning bad. It's not been an easy life. But I would suggest to you that it's not been an easy life in part due to Jacob. God comes to Jacob and blesses him freely. He chose him. The older shall serve the younger before he was even born. The New Testament in Romans says this is God's choice, pure and simple. God isn't looking ahead at what he's going to do. The New Testament says they're twins. Before they were even born, before they had done good or evil, it was said that the older would serve the younger so that the purposes of the God who chooses or calls would stand. It's because of him who calls that designating in Isaac your seed shall be named or called. God just did it sovereignly. He chose this individual. And you say, there was nothing in Jacob to commend him. And you're right. This is grace. This is favor. This is back to that non-justice that we saw with Job. God is doing this freely because he wants to. Even though this man is evil. And truly, he is evil and his brother is evil. And God chooses the one and passes by the other and doesn't harm the other as a result. Because that man freely of his own choice, among other things, sold his birthright with an oath. Well, let's go then to the other pair. Oh, I want to just emphasize how unnecessary. Jacob did not need to do this. In the story at Bethel, Jacob actually makes a deal with God. He says, okay. He says, if you then will be with me and will keep me on this journey and bring me back here to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. And so then I will accept you and you'll be my God. That vow, if you will do this, then I will do this, God. A vow is wheeling and dealing with God. And Jacob doesn't need to do that. He could follow his father Abraham in just believing. It's not until he has to face his brother Esau at Penuel, returning into the land, that finally, after a night of wrestling with the angel, and wrestling with God is not commended by the prophet Hosea, he's still trying to coerce a blessing out of God. I'll wrestle your angel if I have to do it. But when God touches through the angel, touches his hip and dislocates it, and he's all by himself as now a broken man and has to face his brother, as he says, as a man faces God, he's finally, the fear of man is finally snapped, and his orientation is towards God, and God changes his name, which is significant, to a new identity, and he follows through at Bethel later, and God is his God. It was a hard journey, but he makes it. Now, with the time remaining, let's just consider the other two brothers, Judah and Joseph. As you know, Joseph is the youngest at the time. The favored mother, Rachel, has another favored wife, has another son, Benjamin, who's younger. These are the only two that Rachel gives birth to. But because Rachel is the one Jacob really wanted all along, he favors Joseph and gives him the Ferrari. Well, a multicolored coat. But in a day when clothing was very expensive, that was a sign that you are the special boy. And his brothers hated him in envy, could not even speak a word kindly to him. And of course, Joseph isn't helping the matter. He's getting dreams from God how all of the brothers are going to someday bow down to him. You know, and so he's telling these dreams to his brothers. And his brothers are like, look, let's, you know, Joseph's coming to them in a faraway place, far away from dad. And so it's out of sight, out of hearing. And so let's just take him and kill him. Let's see what becomes of those dreams. And Reuben's the oldest, wants to rescue Joseph, bring him back to his dad, but, you know, they throw him into the pit, and Judah gets the bright idea, let's sell him into slavery. Now, with today's trafficking, and you are aware of this, this is evil, as well as psychologically damaging. When Joseph later sees his brothers, it touches me deeply that he has to retreat to the back room and weep. I think when people are abused when they're young, it leaves deep scars, and this is testimony to that. These brothers have deeply wronged Joseph in doing this, and wronged their father, because as soon as he sees that blood-stained, multicolored coat, he puts two and two together, and he refuses to be comforted. As he says, my gray hairs will go down to Sheol in sorrow. Well, that's the phrase he uses later if Benjamin doesn't come back safe. And so grief, dysfunction characterizes this family, and time goes on. Joseph, of course, is in Egypt, and we find out his character is stellar. God's with him, gives him blessing in Potiphar's house, Pharaoh's bodyguard. Potiphar puts him in charge of all his possessions, but the wife has an eye for him and wants to sleep with him. And Joseph avoids her until one day they're the only two in the house, and she says, "Sleep with me." And he runs out of the house. She grabs him and only gets his coat, and he runs out naked, which is unfortunate. She then frames him. You brought this Hebrew slave in here, and now he's tried to sleep with me and seduce me or rape me or something, and Potiphar is spitting mad and throws him into jail. And in jail, of course, the Lord is with him, gives him favor in the warden's sight. He's put in charge of the other prisoners, interprets dreams. One of them has access to the Pharaoh himself, the ruler in Egypt, and the man forgets about Joseph for 2 years. Once he finally remembers him, Joseph is elevated to second in command in the land in a day in which political advisors having clairvoyance or supernatural powers were highly valued. And of course, Joseph is the top of the line. So with that in mind, you know, Joseph, being away from his dad, feared God. He told Potiphar's wife, "How shall I sin against God in doing this great evil implied against your husband?" And so he didn't fear man, he feared God. And that God orientation, so critical, it's what Job was tested on. We find it in Joseph. But we don't get that. I left out something there. Did you catch that? I skipped a chapter. I went from 37 where he sold to 39 where he shows that he fears God even though his family isn't around. And that's the ultimate test. Send a boy off to college. Send a young woman off to school. And see then whether she fears God and will keep his commandments. Okay. What's in between? It looks like it's really out of place. It's Judah. And Judah he's a scoundrel. It's his idea that Jacob be sold. And all we see in chapter 39 is that Judah marries some Canaanites, and of course, they were told, don't marry the Canaanites, and there are people very immoral, and so he's, you know, God kills the oldest son because he was evil, and then the daughter Tamar, the daughter-in-law, is given to the next son, and he doesn't fulfill his duties, and so he's killed, and then Judah's like, I'm not going to have my third son killed, so keeps Tamar, and she then dresses up like a temple prostitute, and he sleeps with her, and gives her his signet ring as surety, or we would say collateral. He's a wicked man. Can we agree with that? There's nothing commendable about Judah at this point. And I remember reading an Old Testament a Jewish scholar named Robert Alter talking about how to interpret Old Testament narratives. And he basically pointed out the significance of chapter 38 being inserted into the story. Don't ignore it. Hebrew narrative doesn't just do things willy-nilly. It's in there for a reason. And what's interesting is, I don't know if it was Alter that I got this from or it was just in my own reading, but at some point it dawned on me that the idea of a surety comes back in the story. Recall with me, the famine is in the land. Joseph has amassed all this storehouse of food. Jacob sends 10 boys down there, 10 grown men, his sons down there, leaves the youngest, Benjamin, Joseph's full brother, behind. And of course, you know, Joseph sees him, recognizes him, the dreams are being fulfilled. But he wants to know whether these sons they genuinely love their dad. If they've repented of the way they treated not just him, but their dad. So he's going to test them by Benjamin needs to come down here. And this father's not going to allow Benjamin down there. But Judah says, send him with me. Let me be surety or collateral for him. If he doesn't come back, you may hold me blameless or blame for it. And so when Joseph then threatens to keep Benjamin because he put the cup in Benjamin's sack, framed him in that way, and it's all this kind of lying again. I'm not sure if all this testing and lying is commendable with God. But we see here Judah steps forward and in a long speech recounts how he cares for his dad and how if you do this, keep Benjamin here, it will kill my father. Don't do it. Put me in prison and let the boy go free. That radical change of character in Judah signifies he has now become a true son of Abraham. It is he then that is blessed in Jacob's blessing that the scepter shall not leave the tribe of Judah. It is through the tribe of Judah that the Messiah will come, the son of David and ultimately Jesus Christ. Judah becomes a Christ figure at this moment. The Bible will teach that Jesus died for the sins of his people. That he died, as Hebrews says, as surety or collateral for the transgressions of the rebellious acts done under the old covenant, where they forfeited on their loan and defaulted on their payments, Jesus stepped forward and said, let my very life be the payment to cover their default. I am their collateral. And Judah says the same thing and substitutes himself for Benjamin before Joseph's eyes. It's a highly provocative scene, full of meaning. And so, the end of the day, we find two tribes. Well, let me just comment. This transformation of character must happen for every individual. The Bible teaches, as we're going to see as we go through it, that every individual is faulty. All the heroes have warts. And as a result of that, they all have guilt. And so, if God's going to be gracious, if God's going to bless them, there has to be some measure of grace involved. And if they're going to be son of the woman, son of Abraham, seed of the woman, seed of Abraham, there has to be a transformation of character. And that transformation of character, according to the book I cited last time in 1 John, is called being born of God or begotten of God. And the very life of God is given to a man. It's the New Testament's explanation for how these individuals can do right things and be regarded as righteous. The faith that they have resembles Abraham, and it's ultimately all that is good in their life is ultimately attributed to the work of God in calling and in changing them. That's a story that we can examine later, and it'll be picked up in church history in our final half of the class as we talk about issues of the will and of nature. But for now, I want you to know where we're at in the Bible's narrative. This book ends by telling us two tribes take the lead. Judah and Ephraim being the blessed son of Joseph. Joseph's two sons are regarded as full sons of Jacob. And so Joseph takes the lead and Judah takes the lead, and it's these two tribes that become the southern part of the land of Canaan, Judah, and the northern part, Israel, or often called Ephraim. And so we're set up for that in the history of the first family themselves and the blessing that Jacob gives to them at the end of the book. As you read, do your review over the weekend of Meyer's article, I want you to go back and skim through it. And so you get the details in mind. Incorporate some of the data from Genesis. If you can, kind of like spice it up a little bit, and that will be due then next class period, and then we'll begin another book as we look at the book of Exodus together. So, thank you.